Now that which is twisted cannot be made right, nor that which is lacking be brought to the light. I spoke with my heart, saying, though I be wise, with knowledge surpassing Jerusalem's guise. And it goes on, but that was Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 15 and 16. In the 2004 version by yours truly, which is our daily proverb for today, little children. So we're now studying the Arkhabirartu, the Orient Express, an article the date of which we have not yet established as to its writing, but we can rest assured it was written before the Trojan War article, which dates to 2015. I would guess, I would just be guessing, but I'm thinking even it could be even 2010 for this article. But one way to find out would be to go to the Will of Jehovah main page and click on the JW and then on the PDF articles and find out from there. But I'm going to look at the bottom here. It should tell us, oh, we'd have to go to part two. Okay. So we'll go to part two. And the bottom, it should give us the information about when it was published. It was modified a few times, on a few occasions, that is. So it's written 2010. And that was a good guess. 2010, it was first published, the Arkhabirartu, which is the present article. Of course, it's for us the present article because we're studying it right now. And we are just beginning chapter 1. We did the introduction for chapter 1 yesterday. But before we even begin reading, let's look at the number 5, which I mentioned yesterday. But I said it was 1.6 something. But the interesting characteristic of the number 5, which is called the golden ratio, by the way, it's a number that's found in many different structures, such as Noah's Ark, and in nature, it's found in the ratio of certain spirals in seashells, for example. You can find that number, the golden ratio, in natural structures. And also, it's known that it's a number that is also present in the Egyptian structure known as the Great Pyramid. So it's a very interesting number 5, but let's just look at it for a moment before we begin reading from chapter 1, paragraph 1 in our article. And it is this number which, when divided into 1, produces itself minus 1. So here is the number itself. After you subtract 1, you get, or after you divide it into 1, it's the same thing, because you get this number 0.618033 8875, approximately. It has an infinite number of decimal places, I believe. It's not a rational number, as indeed many decimals also are. Like pi is also an infinite decimal. I tried to quote 50 decimal places for pi the other day and I got it wrong, but I memorized it at one point. It's 3. For 50 decimal places, pi should be, if I recall it correctly, 3.14159265358973283846263832794197169399375100. 50 decimal places for pi, which has an infinite number of decimal places, of course. It's an irrational number. Now, phi is also irrational, so we're only giving some number like 12, 11 decimal places here, 12 figures for the 1.618033988875. So let's go back for a moment, look at the calculation. Here it is. We're dividing 1. We're saying 1 divided by 1.61803, but let's go 1.6180, that's five significant figures, right? It's called. every number or digit is a significant figure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then we have 33988. That's 5 more, so there are 12 significant figures here. 1 divided by 1.618033988875 equals 0.618033988875. Is that not exactly the identical number? 1.618033988875 and 0.618033987 Right. So there you have this property of phi, which is that when you divide it into 1, it becomes 1 minus itself, or when you divide that number, if we were to take this number here, so let's just go back, let's divide the number 0.618033988875, divide that number into 1, so 1 divided by 0.618033988875, that's 1.618033988875, or phi, that's phi. So this is the characteristic that phi has. No other number has this characteristic, that when you divide it into 1, or that other number, 1 minus phi, into 1, you get either 1 minus phi or you get phi, depending on which one you're doing. But it always returns to itself after the decimal point. It's identical, right? Amazingly. But if you've got the number of significant figures accurate, then you'll know it's the right number if, when you divide it into 1, you get the same numbers after the decimal, the same digits. That's the characteristic of the golden ratio. Okay, that's enough on that. But it's also possible to calculate what it is using an expression that involves the root of 2, the square root of the number 2, I believe, or is it not? I think that's right, or is it not? But we'll see from... Well, let's show you. We'll show you. Later in the article, we say, here it is, and it's the square root of 5, actually. That it's the square root of 5, that it's not the square root of 2, but it involves the number 2 divided by 2. So it's, in brackets, 1 plus the square root of 5, end bracket, divided by 2. That is a precise representation of phi, because the square root of 5 is also irrational, so that's why it produces an irrational number, which, if this were not irrational, we'd know it wasn't a precise it couldn't be a precise representation of phi. And just because it's irrational doesn't mean it's a precise representation of phi, because there are many irrational numbers, but this particular irrational number, which is in brackets 1 plus the square root of 5, end bracket, divided by 2, that is a precise representation of phi. So let's show that. Okay, that's the next thing to show here. 1, okay, we'll put a bracket before the 1, and we'll say 1, let's just delete all these other numbers, 1 plus the square root of phi, where is it? Do they have a simple square root here? Well, we can just say phi, or 5, rather, it's 5. We can say the square root of 5 is also written as 5 to the exponent. Of 0.5. That's what a square root is. And 5 to the exponent of 0.5 added to 1, all in brackets, divided by 2 should give us that same number, 1.618, etc. 1.618033988875. This is the accuracy of this calculator. It doesn't go beyond, currently anyway, it doesn't go beyond that number of decimal places. So the number phi continues on beyond those numbers. It doesn't end with those digits, but that's accurate enough, right, for our purposes. So it's fine. Now, is there a way to represent the square root of, I don't know. Let's try and represent the square root of 5 here by some other method. Square root, yeah, like that. square root of 5. Right, it gives an... That's not right. Yeah, 1 plus square root of 5 is probably correct. It's 3.2, whatever. Put a bracket. End the bracket, and then divide by 2. I mean, just complete all the brackets. Divide by 2. 1.618033988875. So that's another way of just using the calculator to compute the square root of 5. That proves that the square root of 5 equals the same thing as 5 to the exponent of 0.5. Or 5 to the 1/2 power. That's what a square root is. Just for anyone interested in mathematics or arithmetic or computation. Now let's begin reading this article, which is a wonderful topic, not necessarily saying anything about the authorship of this article, but that the topic itself is a wonderful one. Do you know how to build a fire? A much neglected and perhaps long forgotten art, fire building, has been practiced since ancient times by people who lived even before the deluge. Tubal Cain used fire to refine metals even before the time that we call the era of the dreamers. We've broken these time periods, which are called eras, and they're 63 times 36 in our genealogy. They equal 2268 in total. That's the number of years in an era from the time of the deluge, as well as from the time of Adam to the deluge. But from the time of the deluge to the time of Solomon, we have this 2268, which is the difference between 3282 and 1014 BCE. Right? So, if I were to say 63 times 36 plus 1014, I didn't plan to do much math, but today, what we're doing it anyway, 3282, there it is. So, you see that there's a difference of 2268, which is a rather nice number, being 36 times 63, where the digits of 36 are just reversed from the digits of 63, so it's easy to remember how to calculate 2268 as just 36 times 63, or 63 times 36. Fire building is an art, but it draws upon a number of skills. Fire may be used in conjunction with a wood stove. Right? Right. Okay, you can have a wood stove that keeps the fire safe, prevents it from, at least hopefully prevents it from burning down the dwelling in which the wood stove is standing. So you can use a wood stove with fire for heat, burning the fire in the wood stove. But the building of a fire using kindling and larger chunks of wood is far more difficult than fueling a burning fire. Once the fire is burning, in other words, it's much easier. Really, we don't say more easy. We say easier. I don't know. Nowadays, because so many people are learning English as a new language, correct grammar is not really all that common anymore, because people are using whatever they can. They're doing the best they can to learn the language, but there's no real way of, in English, to say more easy is really not correct. It's actually easier. It's called easier, and there are many cases like that, but not every case is like that. So it's easier to keep a fire going, or it's, you know, than it is to start and build one, which is far more difficult, because what you're trying to do when you build a fire is, you build the fire, then you light it, and it just keeps going, if you build it right. A small flame is a fragile thing and must be fed properly. Too much wood too quickly and pieces too large fail to go. You don't want to have a small flame trying to burn a large piece of wood initially. You need to start with small flame with smaller pieces of wood. Timing is also important if the flame is to be encouraged. So the timing of when the flame will reach the bigger pieces of wood, for example, and the necessity for air to circulate under the wood also requires consideration in the design of the fire geometry. So you like to stack the wood, you know, like maybe two pieces side by side and then another two perpendicular on top that are side by side on top of the first two. So you keep stacking like that maybe, or whatever you can do in the geometry that you have inside the firebox. But also the smaller pieces are on the bottom. You can also put kindling on top of a fire sometimes too to keep it going, to help rekindle it, and you don't always have to stick the new kindling underneath the fire itself to rekindle it. But generally when you start a fire, it's when you start that fire, you do want the smallest pieces at the bottom. What first appears to be a simple exercise is not so easy, right? It's less easy is the opposite of easier, right? Less easy or not so easy. To be able to quickly build a flame into a roaring fire is quite satisfying. That's really true. It's really, especially when it's cold, it's even more satisfying, but it's satisfying because of the skill it takes to build a fire. And to be able to design a fire geometry that can sustain the flames to the end is also time-saving. If you can just light a fire, put the wood on top, or light it, you don't put the wood on top after you light it. You put all the wood in place, then you light the fire. I mean, you can put wood on top any time, but it's a lot more, risky that you're going to spill some smoke or something out of the wood stove, or you're going to, which you don't want, or you're going to burn yourself when you're trying to add wood. So it's nice if you can just put all the wood in there, light it, and have it sustain the flames right to the end and burn right down until it's done burning. In other words, everything is turned to ash, completely to ash. And you can have quite large pieces on the top and still have that happen if you've got the right design for the fire geometry. That's what that's talking about. And the reason that was brought up is probably because we imagine that when the ark landed, it probably was something that was used as firewood, right, to help the survivors, Noah and his family of sons and their wives. Noah, his three sons and their wives, and Noah's wife, so there were eight people. It would have helped them to be able to use the wood from the ark to make fire, right? And thereby, you know, survive more easily having just landed from this cataclysmic event, which is described in the Bible. So that, and this is the table we, or chart we talked about yesterday, showing all the different descriptions of a global deluge in different cultures, with the most closely corresponding ones to the Bible record being the Assyrian flood legends, as they're called, or Assyrian accounts of the deluge, you could say. They correspond almost exactly to the Bible account, almost exactly, certainly one of them corresponds in every respect to all the criteria given here. Man was in transgression. It was a divine destruction. There was a favored family. The ark was provided by someone, in this case Noah. There was a destruction by water. Human seed was, what happened? Saved. Animal seed was saved. It was a universal destruction. There was a landing on a mountain. Birds were sent out. The survivors worshipped. And there was divine favor on the saved. And now I'd like to get back to, well, let's watch some more of the movie we were watching yesterday. From, before we do that, wait a minute, have I even, I have, okay. Well, I don't know if the volume level is set right, so I'll adjust that as we go. And let me see if we've got, let's...
From here we have the logs transported to Callao, the seaport town of Lima, the Peruvian capital. The Peruvian authorities were so interested in our expedition that the President of the Republic personally ordered the strictly guarded naval dockyard with all its technical facilities to be made available to us, and that we should have the assistance of its personnel to build our raft. The 9 large balsa logs provided the structural basis for our raft. They would transport us across the ocean. We made deep grooves in each log to house the ropes that had lashed the logs together, and to ensure that these would not slide off once the smooth logs started twisting with the impact of the waves. On top of these 9 logs, which constituted the actual raft, we lashed 9 smaller transverse logs. These were to bind the other logs firmly together and to provide the basis for our deck, which consisted of a bamboo platform. Bamboo rods were split lengthwise and plated with a view to making the deck as tough and pliable as possible. Indian log rafts and Eskimo dog sleds both faced the same problem. They had no nails or rivets. For this reason, as they had no rigid joints, they had to be as elastic and pliable as possible. Among primitive races, the golden rule was, don't resist nature, but yield to her commands and accommodate. Finally, our raft was launched. A vessel without a single nail, rivet, or screw. Everything was fastened together, Indian fashion, with ropes. A small hut made of bamboo rods was lashed to the middle of the raft. Under the vigilant gaze of a number of pelicans, we attached a slab of balsa with strong thole pins to accommodate the steering oar. The last lashings and knots, more than 300 in all, were eventually completed. From excavated graves in Peru, we know that the Indians were past masters at making almost unbreakable rope from tough fibers. We then stepped the masts. Like our predecessors, we had 2 raked masts stepped side by side, joined together at the top. In order to withstand wind pressure, they were made of a wood so hard that it was incapable of floating. The yard to which our square sail was bent was of bamboo poles lashed together. When the raft was completed, it was towed to a nearby yacht club, where the authorities and the general public had an opportunity to inspect it before our departure. Large crowds turned up, including ambassadors and ministers representing 9 different countries. We were treated to numerous dire forebodings. The country's leading shipping exporter maintained that the raft would sink before we were halfway across. The port authorities insisted on a written declaration before we set off, absolving them from all responsibility, while a naval attaché somewhat rashly bet us all the whiskey the entire crew would ever be able to consume that we'd never make it to the Pacific Islands. People were keen to secure our autographs, no doubt convinced that this was their last chance of doing so. After expressing our gratitude to the Peruvian liaison officer for his assistance, the raft was solemnly christened Contiki with the milk from a coconut in order to conform to past tradition. The expedition secretary, Gerd Vold, was given a bouquet of sunflowers as a reminder that Contiki was the name of the sun god in the ancient Inca legends. According to Peruvian tradition, a nation with a white king was said to have ruled the land before the Incas took over. His head is hewn in prehistoric stone statues high up in the Andes. One of these provided a model for the head on our sail. The last we hear of Contiki in these ancient legends is that he was banished from Peru and disappeared with his people across the Pacific. In the Polynesian islands too, people speak of the great Tiki, who brought their ancestors to the islands. We were now going to follow in his footsteps. On April the 28th, 1947, the pelicans, for the first time for hundreds of years, were startled at the sight of a balsa raft heading for the open sea. A naval tug towed us out of the bay to ensure that we had not been in the way of coastal traffic. We bade farewell to the tug and rowed across to the raft in a small rubber dinghy, which we were later to use when filming the Contiki out at sea. After waving goodbye to the tug, We were on our own, afloat on our nine balsa woods. The nearest archipelago lay some 5,000 miles ahead of us. That is to say, the same distance as from Callao to San Francisco, or from San Francisco to Iceland, or from Iceland to Ethiopia.
I can't do anything about the ad. Can't stop it. So we'll just probably end at that point, I think, for now. We've got a few more minutes here to discuss other things. I don't know how long the ads are going to go. So, okay, there we are.
On the very first day, the trade wind blew from the chilly Antarctic. There was no one who could teach us how to maneuver an Inca raft, and we had to learn by trial and error from the very first day at sea.
That's at 11:05. Yeah, I think that's a good place to stop. We're just about the same distance in time that we were from the beginning. As we watched from the beginning yesterday, so we're just about at the right point to stop for today and that. There's still more to look at today. It's so fascinating. I've got a map of the location of Noah's Ark in Turkey, which is near Yüzengili here on the map. And Yüzengili is a small place, whereas the major city to which the site of Noah's Ark is closest is Dugubiyazıt in Turkey. So you may hear someone referring to the site of Noah's Ark as being at the city of Dugubiyazıt or Dugubiyazıt, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, in the Turkish language, however you would pronounce it in your language would be the way to pronounce it. But also, I want to show you these drawings that were made by the naval architect Samuel Windsor. They show the Ark of Noah with detailed drawings. I mean, this is not a typical... Let me get back here to the size. There we go. This is not a typical sketch by somebody who is unqualified, you know, to make drawings of ships. It's by an architect of ships. The man who made this drawing, based on the work of the researchers who included Ron Wyatt, and one of whom was David Fassold. And he wrote a book, which I haven't read yet, but David Fassold was somebody who, at a later time, he lost faith in the idea that this was Noah's Ark, and then he possibly again regained his faith, I believe, but it's very difficult to have faith, and it's easy to lose your faith in the world because there are so many people who come up with ways around it, you know, easy ways to circumvent your faith or easy ways to adopt a different view, you know, such as a geologist who comes out and says, well, this is a natural formation, it's not man-made, which is one of the things that did happen during all of this research. But we see that this man drew a detailed drawing of Noah's Ark, and the bow is to the right here, forward, it says. And it's larger in the bow than it is in the stern, which is a very pointy end. And we see the moon. The moon pool is shown as this center rectangle here, with iron masses present at the stern or of the moon pool, or the rear of the moon pool, for the anchor stones. Evidently, those were where the anchor stones were suspended from the ark, and the anchor stones were found on the ground at some distance away from the landing site, having been ditched by Noah. It seems incredible to even talk about it, using the names of the people on the boat and everything. Noah was the one, and his sons, who would have, and their wives, who would have been ditching these anchor stones prior to landing the boat, because the anchor stones would not have helped them land if the anchor stone, once the anchor stones became grounded, of course, they could prevent the boat from being maneuvered correctly. But they ditched these stones, evidently, maybe just a few kilometers or a few hundreds of meters away. And that's shown in this other drawing, if I can find it here, right here. This is also provided by Mr. Windsor, where the anchor stones are here. Dugubiyazit is here, and the ark is here. So it's like the anchor stones are quite a distance away, apparently. Let's look at that Google map one more time, if we have time. We're almost out of time. Look at the scale. Let's look at the scale. 10 kilometers is that much. Okay. So Yuzangili is there. So Dugubiyazit is probably about 20 kilometers from the ark. And on this drawing, so they ditched it quite a distance. The anchor stones that were ditched, if that's 20 kilometers between the ark here and Dugubiyazit, and the ark, then that being 20 kilometers, the distance from the ark to the anchor stones is probably 20, 40, 60 kilometers where the anchor stones were ditched. So once they sighted land, perhaps, if they could see land from 60 kilometers, which would be a long distance, that's like, what is that, times, you have to divide by, or multiply by 6, it's 36 miles, I guess, something like that, about 36 miles away. Could you really see your landing site from 36 miles away? Well, if it's a mountain, I guess, and it's the only thing above the water, maybe you could. But I didn't realize there was that big of a distance to where they actually ditched the stones. It's fascinating. But they found the stones. That's talked about by Mr. Windsor, but it's, or by somebody, evidently. We'll get to it. That's it for today. It's September 3rd, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 1638 hours Eastern Daylight Time in North America. I'm Ward Green. And thank you for listening and watching. I love you very much. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty. This is Cassie. And I'm trying to think. I'd like to find out who mentioned the anchor stones. But there's a picture in the article. Here it is. Right. Yeah, Mr. Windsor's the one who talks about the anchor stones. Okay. Bye for now.